Welcome to the Practical Employment Law Podcast, a podcast covering all aspects of American employment law. I'm your host, Mark Chumley. This is part two of my podcast mini-series on termination done right. If you have not done so, I suggest you listen to episodes number 3 and number 7 before this one. In Termination Done Right Part 1, I covered a lot of the common mistakes employers make with terminations. These were all things for employers to avoid. In this episode, I want to talk about the things employers should do, proactive steps that will help avoid problems with terminations if and when they become necessary. The first thing I want to talk about are policies. Most employers have at-will disclaimers, which are helpful, and most also have policies about termination of employment, but many of these are not helpful. Having a well-crafted termination policy can be a real asset if you get sued. So what does that look like? First, you need to be clear that the employer has the discretion to terminate employment at will under whatever circumstances it deems appropriate. There is a tendency in termination policies to list a few really bad things that employees can be immediately terminated for doing, and then move on to various steps of discipline such as first written warning, second written warning, etc. The problem with this is that if you don't word the policy the right way, you can lock yourself into a limited number of scenarios where you can terminate immediately and create an implication that employees are entitled to various steps of discipline in other scenarios. My experience is that there are an infinite number of things employees do that might lead an employer to want to immediately terminate employment, but I also get the idea of providing guidance to employees about where the boundaries are for behavior. For example, you might include something obvious in that immediate termination list, like fighting or drinking on the job. Those are easy. You would probably not include tardiness, and most employers would be inclined to give a few warnings for tardiness. But there are scenarios where you might want to terminate after one tardy. Maybe a manager tells an employee to be on time in the future, and the employee laughs and says, "Not going to happen, I'll get here when I get here." Perhaps this same employee is not really working out, and this is a final straw for the manager. You don't want to be locked into a series of warnings for this employee. So what do you do? Well, the policy needs to be written in a way that maintains employer discretion. You can list those obvious infractions like fighting, but you can also include a catch-all, something like the employer retains sole discretion to terminate employment with or without prior warnings. There are a lot of ways to do it, but the key is not locking yourself into an obligation to give warnings to an employee that you want to part ways with. Some of you may be shaking your heads and saying, "This is obvious," but I've encountered this issue again and again in litigation and continue to fix this issue in policies and handbooks on a regular basis. If this is an issue for you, I suggest that you get that policy fixed ASAP. Another thing to watch with policies, you have to make sure that they make sense and that they work together. Often employers start with a set of policies and over a period of years add to and revise them. What happens in some cases is that they end up with some inconsistent or even contradictory policies. A common scenario where this happens is with attendance policies. Maybe an employer has a good termination policy with lots of discretion built in, but over time adopts an attendance policy that is very regimented. Maybe it even has a point system. This can create an inconsistency between the policies that will come out if there is litigation. The answer is to periodically do a comprehensive policy review. One more word about policies. I've said this before. Don't make a policy that you are unwilling or unable to follow consistently. It's fine to create an elaborate attendance point system, but if your best employee racks up the right number of points, you need to be prepared to terminate. If you don't, you're inviting discrimination claims. So to sum up our first proactive step, review and clean up policies that touch on termination of employment. The next thing I want to cover is investigations. I think I could do a whole episode or more on this topic, and I might, but for now, I want to hit a few key points. First, a little background. When I talk about investigations in this context, I am talking about the employer's investigation of facts and circumstances that lead to a decision to terminate employment. I'm not covering an investigation into a complaint of discrimination or harassment, although in many cases they overlap. And I am stating that even in the most obvious cases, there should be some form of investigation. Why? Well, if you listen to my thoughts on at-will employment, you know that employers have to be able to make a case for termination to defend against employment law claims such as discrimination. The mistake employers often make is doing no investigation or a very cursory investigation, and when they get sued, it comes back to haunt them. With that in mind, I'll give you a few important thoughts on investigations, although this is by no means a comprehensive discussion. Thought number one, investigate thoroughly. As I mentioned, when you're terminating an employee, there should be an investigation to back it up, and the investigation must be thorough. What does that mean? Unfortunately, it's different from case to case. Let's say you're considering termination of an employee for cursing out a coworker in the break room. Let's also say there were three employees at the table in the break room: the employee who did the cursing, the recipient of the cursing, and a bystander. If you interview all three about the incident, is that thorough? If there are only three people in the break room, it may be thorough. But if the room was crowded and the tables are close enough together for others to hear what happened, you should probably interview additional witnesses, unless no one is disputing what happened. If additional allegations are raised, and maybe the bad actor employee says he was provoked because the other employee called him a racial slur the week before, if that comes up, you should find out if it's true, possibly by interviewing witnesses to an entirely different incident. I'm not suggesting that this would even change the ultimate decision to terminate, but the key to defending a possible lawsuit is having a thorough understanding of relevant facts before making a decision. Another thought, choose the right investigator. In most cases, the person who investigates is either an HR professional or a frontline manager, and in most cases, that's fine. However, if the target of the investigation has a negative history with one of them or has previously complained about them, they may not be the best choice to investigate. Remember, the investigator will be a key witness in any litigation over a termination. If that person's credibility is easily attacked, say because they have a grudge against the terminated employee, then the whole investigation is weakened. It would be better to have someone truly neutral do the investigation. Next thought, interview witnesses effectively. This is another topic that we cannot cover in detail in this format, but it bears mentioning if only briefly. If you are doing an investigation that may lead to termination, you need information, and you need to get it from witnesses. You cannot let yourself be put off by vague answers or reluctance to cooperate. At the same time, you're not the police, and you cannot necessarily demand answers from reluctant witnesses. Clearly, there is a balance to be struck, and I think it's this. Ask thorough and complete questions, follow up where answers are unclear or incomplete, but stop when it becomes clear that you've exhausted the witness. That is, you've gotten everything the witness will give you. If someone is completely uncooperative, you make a note of that and draw whatever conclusions are appropriate. When you've done all that, move on. A couple of additional tips. Start asking broad questions and move to more specific ones. I don't like working off a script because the tendency is not to listen to the answers, and listening carefully is the most important skill for an interviewer. Also, watch out for the reluctant witness's favorite trick, answering a different question than the one that was asked. In my example of the break room altercation, you might ask a witness if they heard the exchange between the two employees. A reluctant witness might give an answer like, "I had my headphones on." Notice that the answer is not responsive because the witness may have heard what the employee said even with the headphones on. It's an attempt to get out of answering the question and get the questioner to back off. You should follow up on an answer like that. Another point, never interview witnesses alone. You should always have a second manager present for interviews and have them take notes. Finally, you don't have to get witness statements. You can, but it's not necessarily the best approach in every case. Detailed notes are valid documentation of an interview. Speaking of detailed notes, my next point is another one I've mentioned before. Thoroughly document your investigation. A rule of employment law is if you don't write it down, it didn't happen. You may be called upon to remember an investigation in detail years after the fact. You need to have thorough and complete notes and documentation to be able to do that. This is especially important with witness interviews where there may be a dispute about what was said. And it's not enough to just copy down what was said in the meeting. You need to be able to recreate the interview. You need to note things like who was present, the date, and maybe even time, location, and length of the interview. The more details, the better. Another key point. If you are taking down dialogue, You need to be clear about who is speaking. I know this sounds obvious, but I've seen this issue come up again and again in litigation. Someone took almost verbatim notes of an interview, but it's not clear who made which statements. It can completely ruin an otherwise solid interview. Moving on. We've completed a thorough and detailed investigation and are ready to move to the termination decision and meeting. The need for effective documentation does not end with the investigation. If an explanation is needed for the termination decision, write one out. Also, when you meet with the employee to advise them of the decision, you need to have a management witness present, and you need to take good notes of that meeting as well. This can be critical if there's litigation. What did the employee say about the termination decision? Did the employee raise any issues, say about discrimination? What statements were made by the managers? These are all questions that may play a significant role in litigation. Managers may be asked to testify about these facts in detail years after the fact, so it is critical again to have thorough notes. So there you have it, proactive steps to do terminations the right way. In the final episode in this series, I'm going to talk about the use of arbitration agreements, jury waivers, and class action waivers, what they do, and whether they're right for your business. I hope you'll join me for that. This has been the Practical Employment Law Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please watch for future episodes wherever you get podcasts. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. If you would like to contact me about any aspect of the podcast, my email address is mchumley@kmklaw.com, and my full contact information is in the show notes. This podcast was created for general informational purposes only and does not constitute legal advice or a solicitation to provide legal services. Although we attempt to ensure that the podcast is complete, accurate, and up to date, we assume no responsibility for its completeness, accuracy, or timeliness. The information in this podcast is not intended to create, and listening to it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Listeners should not act upon this information without seeking professional legal counsel.